Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
All right. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are cribbing some theme music from our friends who do a show on Sunday, the morning after. Check it out every Sunday at 3 o'clock. But you today are listening to the Farm Report. It's because it's Thursday. It's 1 o'clock, so you're probably aware of that. We are coming to you, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza. It's a lovely day here in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn, and I'm super excited. My guest today is the ever famous, one of our favorites here at the Heritage Radio Network, Will Harris. Will, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here. Hope you're all doing good today.
Oh, I'm feeling good because I can walk down the street without having soaking, freezing feet, which is the first. Now, you guys have been getting some crazy weather down there, too. Has that been impacting you guys at the farm?
Well, not Atlanta, yes, but we're about 3 hours south of Atlanta. I'm only about 80 miles from the Gulf of Mexico, and it is really a great place to live. We get about 60 inches of rain. It almost never freezes, and there's something green growing 52 weeks a year in my pastures. So, you know, we're blessed.
I'm jealous. I'm going to be honest. Well, for folks who want to hear some of the basic background of Will's farm, White Oak Pastures, definitely tune in to the Farm Report, the episode 139, where we go over that in pretty much detail. Today, what I really want to focus our conversation on is your work with Whole Foods and the Global Animal Partnership. Now, is it correct that you're the only farm in the U.S. that's 5-plus certified on 4 species? Is that right?
That is correct. The 4 species that Global Animal Partnership currently has standards for is cattle, hogs, turkeys, and chickens. And we raise all 4 of those, as well as 6 other species. And 5-plus is the highest level that they extend. And we have a 5-plus in all 4 species.
Well, so I wanna talk about those steps. So, you know, it's step 1 through 5 and then 5-plus. And I'm hoping that maybe you can talk to us a little bit about where these steps came from, what the impetus was, and how we as consumers should be kind of thinking about the ratings when we're out and about shopping and trying to be responsible purchasers of meat.
I sure will. The Global Animal Partnership is unique in that it does have step categories for increasingly good animal welfare or animal husbandry. There are 2 other very good, very, very good animal welfare verifiers in this country. They are Animal Welfare Approved, AWA, and Certified Humane. That's Humane Animal Farm Animal Care. Both of those are excellent programs. But what makes GAP, a Global Animal Partnership, unique is a farmer can be very industrial, conventional, factory farmer. He can make some improvements and get credit for it and be a step 1. He can, you know, and then over time, if he can further improve, he can go to step 2, then step 3, 4, 5, then 5-plus. So it's beneficial in that a farmer doesn't have to go from doing a really not so great job with reference to animal welfare to doing a really good job without any appreciation for that.
For the steps along the middle. Well, and I feel like you're the perfect person to talk to about this, because when you started farming, your production looked a lot, you know, your production methods looked a lot different than they do today. So maybe can you talk a little bit about that transition point for folks who maybe aren't familiar with your work?
Certainly. My great-grandfather came here about 150 years ago. It was in 1866 after the Civil War. And he would have raised animals in a manner that had a very high level of animal welfare and a high level of environmental sustainability or stewardship. His son was my grandfather, farmed much the same way, but during my father's watch, post-World War II, was the era when virtually all Americans centralized, commoditized, and industrialized. And my father was no exception. He did that. And, of course, that made food cheap and abundant, but it really took a toll on animal welfare, environmental stewardship, and the economics of rural America. All paid for it. During my watch, commencing in the mid-90s, I started improving those things. And today I've got two daughters and a son-in-law, and we run what we believe is a very high animal welfare, high environmentally sustainable operation. We raise five red meat species and hand butcher them on the farm. And we pasture-raise five poultry species and hand butcher them on the farm, as well as serve out organic vegetables and eggs.
Can you talk a little bit about when you say the toll was felt by economies of rural America? I think that's an issue that gets a little bit of a short shift in discussions. I feel like we're, as a kind of increasingly conscientious consumers, familiar with the animal welfare issues and more familiar with the animal welfare and the environmental concerns. But maybe you can tell us a little bit when you talk about the economies of rural America that were impacted by those production shifts, what you mean and like how that kind of played out.
Sure. During the post-Depression era, after the Depression, into the Great Depression, which started about 1930, rural America enjoyed a vibrant local economy, many local economies. Small farm towns enjoyed a lot of prosperity, and that started to erode in the industrialization that occurred after World War II. We centralized production. I say that we centralized, industrialized, and commoditized. The centralization of production caused all of the local value-added processes to leave rural small towns and be centralized into large factory operations. Think of the Chicago packing houses. Sinclair Lewis wrote, what was the book? The Jungle, right. That was an example of the centralization of the meat business. You know, prior to that occurring, every little small town had a little family-owned abattoir or packing house, very similar to what I have here on my farm, where they processed red meat and or poultry. It was grown locally, processed locally, marketed and consumed locally. That's what my family did here for the first 75 years. So to bring it home, my farm, White Oak Pastures, today employs 100 employees. 100 employees on this farm. Prior to my changing the way I farmed in the mid-90s, I had 3 employees, all of whom were fairly minimum wage sorts of jobs. Today, out of the 100 employees we have, nobody makes minimum wage. Everybody's above that. We've got a bonus program. We contribute to health insurance, and we all eat lunch together, family style, in my little own farm restaurant, and employees pay $1 per meal for that privilege. So it's, you know, we have 100 jobs, but they're quality jobs, and those jobs resulted from us on this farm decentralizing, deindustrializing, and decommoditizing.
Thank you for that. And I feel like, I don't know, it kind of, it's just like the story warms my heart. And well, I want to come back to the GAP steps. And I'm hoping what we can do is take a walk through each of the steps. And, you know, I was really surprised when I pulled them up on the Whole Foods website, how simple they were listed. And so I'm hoping that maybe you can talk to us a little bit about how operationally these different steps are understood. So the first step is, you know, step one, no crates, no cages. Animals live their lives with space to move around and stretch their legs.
Yeah. And it varies across the four species. And to take them step by step gets a little bit cumbersome. For example, there is no step three for cattle.
Okay. So
but essentially what the Global Animal Partnership has done, it was originally formed out of seed capital from Whole Foods, but it was spun off into an independent organization with a board of directors that supervises the executive director. A lady named Ann Malone is serving as that executive director right now. They have a panel of advisors who are animal welfare, animal behaviorist experts from all over the world, and they set those standards. And the first one, step one, is really pretty low-hanging fruit. It is better than a conventional factory farm, but it's pretty easy to achieve it. It's the training wheels. It's where people can start, and it's not too difficult or expensive to go to step one. Step two, a little harder, a little more expensive. Three, a little harder, more expensive, and so on. We overcomplicate what is good animal welfare. I'll give you the cowboy wisdom on that. There was a time when good animal welfare simply meant that the stockman or owner did not intentionally inflict pain and suffering on the animal. And if the people didn't intentionally inflict pain and suffering, it was considered to be pretty good animal welfare. And that was the industrial model, the factory farm model. As we stockmen became more enlightened, and consumers honestly helped with that enlightenment, we came to realize that's really not good animal welfare. Good animal welfare means that we, the stockman, the herdsman, must create an environment in which the animal can express its instinctive behavior. You know, cows were born to roam and graze. Hogs were born to root and wallow. Chickens were born to scratch and peck. All of these are instinctive behaviors that are inborn. And when we create the factory farm environment, we deprive those animals of that right, of that opportunity, So good animal welfare just means you create the environment for them to do that. And it's really, you know, there's some really complicated protocols to determine what is good animal welfare, but the big tip is if you enjoy watching the animals, if you would like to open up a lawn chair and have a glass of wine and just watch them, that's probably good animal welfare. If you don't enjoy watching them, it's probably bad animal welfare. Nobody other than a psychotic wants to watch a hog in a farrowing crate or a cow bogging in feces or breathing fecal dust or a chicken, you know, in a huge barn or laying battery cages. It's a cruel environment because they can't express instinctive behavior.
So I think what you're saying makes sense, that ultimately our instincts of good behavior are correct. I mean, when we think about like how we would want an animal to be taken care of and what feels good to us, we should follow those instincts. But obviously when you're looking at a business or at an industry, there's a need to set, you know, a stricter definition. So I feel like what I'm hearing from you is the kind of steps that I'm guessing as they're laid out on the website, there's, you know, a second or a third layer to them that breaks them down more specifically by species and with more specific protocols. I mean, is that right? Or I just kind of want to understand like how we as consumers can be thinking about the steps and about kind of what they actually mean. Because they all sound like a very nice progression. And obviously, as you mentioned, there's a panel of experts that was put together to make these decisions. But if I'm an owner operator, I decide, okay, I want to start engaging in this GAP certification, do I get a booklet? Does someone come and visit my farm? I mean, how do I know that I'm moving in the right direction? And who says you were step one and now you're step two?
Okay. The first part of that is that all those steps are oriented so that each one, one at the bottom, five at the top, each one allows the animal to operate with to enjoy more and more of their instinctive behaviors. At one, it's not so good. Two's a little better. Five is deemed to be the best, and the best, as is determined by their panel of experts. And, you know, as a lifelong stockman and I have my degree in animal husbandry, and they're good. I mean, those people know what they're doing, and they've done a good job. So GAP sets the standards. The farmer hires the third-party verifier to come out to the farm and look and conduct an audit to see if indeed, or to determine indeed at what level we're operating. And of course, the standards are available to the farmer before the auditor gets there, so he can look and see, you know, if I don't change this or this or this, I'm going to wind up with a step one. I really aspire to be a two or three or four or five, so I got to change some stuff. And the auditor comes out, and he's has a protocol on a decent sized farm. It's pretty much an all day audit, and he asks. The auditor goes and looks at the livestock. He asks hard questions. He looks at records, and he makes the determination of this is a step 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever.
Right.
So. There are no real surprises. It's really just a verification of what indeed the farm was really doing.
Well, Will, we are going to take just a short break, and we come back. I want to talk about kind of the very beginning of animal welfare. I want to talk a little bit about how we should be thinking about genetics. But hang tight. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Thank you. You're listening to Running Like a Ghost by Shadowbox on heritageradionetwork.org.
And I packed a bag and followed the sun, and I run away from me. It was all a blur, it was all a mess with the three.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
All right, we're back. We are on the line with Will Harris of White Oak Pastures. We're talking about GAP certifications. Now, Will, we've talked a little bit about the different steps that people should be thinking about with regards to ensuring and, you know, an increase in animal welfare. I want to talk a little bit about genetics, because I think that's another topic that we're hearing more and more here at the station is, you know, are the types of animals that we're growing on farms in line with our values as well? And I'm wondering if you would talk about that idea a little bit and how you think about that on your farm.
Yes. Genetics is very, very important. Through many generations of selective breeding, we have changed animals from the way they were 50 or 100 or 200 years ago into something quite different. And we're not talking about genetic engineering here. We're just talking about selective breeding. In many cases, what's used is line breeding, which is a kind word for interbreeding. And it's amazing how much change can be made using these practices. And there's no better example than the chicken. Here on my farm, we use a heritage breed cross. It takes us 12 weeks to make to grow a 3 to 4 pound dressed chicken. An industrial bird in confinement that's been genetically bred to do so can make a 5 pound chicken in less than 6 weeks. So it's way over twice as fast growth as what I have here. Now, quality of life for the bird is very, very different. You know, our birds literally can fly. They fly up and land on a limb and roost at night. They walk, scratch, peck. The birds that grow so fast, in fact, grow so fast that they wind up having problems, particularly with their feet and legs. And you know, a lot of work's been done describing exactly how fast these birds grow, but it is absolutely incredible. And they really have a very, the industry puts it, have a low biological need. In other words, they pretty much are happy to sit in one place and eat and defecate and grow flesh. It's a pretty disgusting animal from my perspective.
Yeah, I feel like in my experience, one of the things I thought was interesting, a farm that I spent some time on, we raised some of the, you know, more popular conventional birds out on pasture, and we literally had to put the feed on one side of the pen and the water on the other to force them to move. And it was a strange thing. If a bird stuck around past that, for us, it was a 7-8 week point, they would, yeah, it would get hurt. It would die. I mean, it seemed like there was almost like, if you weren't harvesting it, for someone's dinner plate, that the bird's life would be ended shortly anyway. which it is just kind of like a crazy, I don't know, it's a crazy thing to me. Well, I want to talk a little bit about cost, because you mentioned that earlier, as from a production standpoint, as someone's moving up the gap steps from 1 to 5 to 5+, that on the production end that you're going to see an increase in costs. And I'm wondering, those increase in costs that's coming, in what form? Is it labor? Is it equipment? Is it space? I mean, where are those costs coming? And how, you know, directly is that translated to what the consumer should be expecting to pay? You know, can we assume that a 5+ bird is going to be, you know, twice as much as a step one bird? Does it work like that? Maybe you can talk a little bit about how we think about the cost on both the production end and the consumption end.
That's a very good question. What you have to remember is that since the 1945 or so, really smart people have been working in universities and private industry laboratories to come up with ways to take cost out of meat production. And when we choose, and they've given us a whole arsenal of industrial tools and production methods to do that. And when we make the decision to give those up, we add those costs back. And it's the most interesting part is it's very species specific. In other words, our grass-fed beef, step 5+ grass-fed beef, probably cost us 25 or 30% more to produce than, say, a step 1 grass-fed beef. And that's primarily due to land cost. It takes a lot of land to raise grass-fed animals. In the case of chickens, a step 5+ chicken probably cost 300% more than a step 1 chicken.
Wow.
And that's due primarily to labor and feed cost. Those birds, those genetically bred birds, bred to gain weight fast, are so efficient in their conversion of corn and soy to poultry meat, and then in the even the step one is cage free, but there may be 20 something thousand of them in one long building with self feeders and self waterers, whereas in my production model, you can see it on our website, whiteoakpastures.com. An employee has to go and visit every house every day, 7 days a week, twice, once to feed them and once to water them. And that's Christmas and New Year's and the 4th of July as well. So it's the cost of raising chickens is increased far more than the cost of raising cattle. The price of pork is out there in the middle somewhere. So it's very species specific. And it's purely a function of having given up the tools that science gave us that takes cost out of production.
So that's surprising to me that the cost is so different from chicken to beef, especially considering that, you know, in 2013 in the U.S., chicken just surpassed beef as the most consumed protein. And I'm wondering, you know, I feel like when people eat chicken, they have this idea that they're eating something that's either, you know, healthier or raised in a way that is more in line with their values. But I don't know, from what I'm hearing you describe, it seems like that's not really an assumption we can make.
No, it's absolutely not an assumption you should make. And one way of thinking about it, one of the reasons that the chicken costs increase its cost so much more than beef is, think of it this way. The smaller the animal, the more handily they adapt to confinement, industrial, factory farming. there's only so much you can do with a cow, a 1,200-1,300-pound cow. But with a little chicken, you know, you can really crowd them in. You can they really lend themselves up to a point of industrialization. And I'll say this, and if somebody asks me to quantify it, I can't do it. But the difference, the quality of life between a step one and step five cow, I think is pretty significant. But the difference in the life of a step one to step five chicken is just exponentially more different. You know, chickens, confinement chickens, have a very, very bleak life. You know, there was a time when chicken was the premium protein. Chicken was what people had for Sunday dinner. Chicken is what people cooked when they had important visitors. You know, fried chicken was the quintessential southern white tablecloth food when you were trying to impress somebody. And chicken became the per capita consumption that you mentioned earlier has skyrocketed because chicken has become so obscenely cheap. You know, you can go to the grocery store sometimes and find whole chickens on sale for less than a dollar a pound. That is obscenely cheap.
You have to wonder, like, where that cost is coming in. Well, I want to touch on two more points because we're just about out of time. But, like, one of the things you said earlier, sticking on this chicken topic, is that because of the breeding technology that's been employed for the commodity birds, that they're, you know, a very, like, they're biologically, they don't have many needs. So I wonder if, do people make the argument, you know, you hear a lot about, like, oh, do, you know, lobsters feel pain when you dump them in the boiling water, and do fish feel pain? I mean, when we're thinking about this, that particular breed of chicken, how do we kind of think of, like, you know, you think of, you know, pigs are supposedly as smart as dogs, and you have a commodity chicken, and you have a heritage breed chicken. Should we feel equally bad for the commodity chicken if it's like it doesn't have the capacity to understand that it's suffering? I mean, how do we think about that? I just feel like it's this thing that I have an innate reaction to, but I'm wondering if we kind of step away from it, what are the expectations that chicken has of happiness, or have the instincts of chickenness been bred out of it? Should we think of it as some other animal, some non-chicken, but some other thing? I don't know if that really makes sense, but I don't know if you have thoughts there.
Yeah, I do, and I think I understand what you're saying. Well, two comments, actually. One is, I think that if you had the opportunity to come and walk with me into the pasture and see our step five birds out scratching and pecking and taking dust baths and chasing each other, and they look like kids in a park, and then, you know, the same day go to a dark, dusty confinement chicken house with high ammonia in the air and see those birds, I don't think you'd have to ask that question much. But let's just say you don't have that opportunity, so let's think about it like this. You know, theoretically, we could breed our children to be couch potatoes that really like to lay in the recliner all day, every day until it's time to go to bed, and then go to bed, and then, you know, get up and eat some more donuts and lay on the couch some more. We could breed a line of humans that were like that. That's kind of what we did with the chickens.
Right.
Now, do you think the quality, and then you take just a regular kid that's just dying to go outside, play football, throw the frisbee, or kick the soccer ball, or shoot for the hoop. Which one do you think's got the highest quality of life?
Right.
And you know, so that's almost exactly what we've done here. And and the same is true. We say that good animal welfare is confining them and keeping them fed and keeping them comfortable. But would that be good parenting? I mean, is it good parenting to take your kids and lock them in a closet so they'll be safe? But I mean, the closet has got a mattress in there, and it's 72 degrees, and the light's left on, so the child is very safe. Nobody can bother it. But it's not much of a quality of life because the kid can't express instinctive behavior.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's at the end of the day, I'm not trying to humanize animals. I don't want to be accused of that. But good parenting and good stockmanship are very similar. There's a lot in common.
There's a lot in common. Yeah, and I only ask that question because I feel like there is a lot of pressure on consumers to think about, to disassociate the humane aspects of animals. You know, look at a protein as a protein, and that leads us down this very dark and slippery slope. Well, my final question, and then I'll let you go. You know, the five plus is that animals must be born and live their entire lives on one farm. And I'm wondering if you can just share with us why that's important, why we should care about that as consumers.
Well, when I farmed very industrially, and I did for 20 years, you know, I would raise, and at that time, I was a monoculture of only cattle. And that's a whole episode, the difference on a monoculture and a polyculture. And the worst thing we did when we made factory farms is we turned them into monocultures of just one animal in which there's no symbiosis. And I can just tell you, nature abhors a monoculture. Nature fights a monoculture. But we would raise, in my case, I was a monoculture of cattle. You know, I would raise, at that time, we could put about 100 head of 450-pound calves on a truck, a double-decker truck that you see running up and down the highway with live cattle on it. And we would take, you know, we did a reasonably good job taking care of the cattle. We certainly did not intentionally inflict pain and suffering on the animals. Instinctive behavior probably wasn't so good, but we didn't hurt them on purpose. But then I'm here in South Georgia on maybe a summer day when it was 90 or 100 degrees in September. We'd load 100 animals on a double-decker truck with the ones on top urinating and defecating on the ones on the bottom, and we'd let them be driven 30 hours to some, you know, Iowa, Nebraska, or Colorado, where the centralized feeding operations were. We talked about centralization, industrialization, and commoditization. And they'd get off that truck, and there's probably, you know, that there may be frost on the ground, and they'd be crowded into pens when they were fed what's called a TMR, total mixed ration, of whatever some nutritionist decided would make them gain weight the most rapidly. And the step 5 plus, where they're raised and harvested on the farm, is an effort to get away from that system and get back to a system where the farm really is the farm that adds the value and has the animal there. You know, our animals here believe that people are their servants, because all they see us do is feed them and water them until the last day of their lives, when we slaughter them. And we raise them and slaughter them with all the respect that we can muster. So that's what step 5 is about.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate you taking some time out to share your insights with us today.
Always a pleasure to be on. Thank you so much for having me.
Folks, if you happen to find yourself in Bluffton, Georgia, definitely stop by the farm for some lunch. You can also learn more about them and where to find their great products by visiting www.whiteoakpastures.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been another episode of The Farm Report. This, like all 35 of our live weekly shows, are available for free. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher Smart Radio, or visit our website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. We are a member-supported, nonprofit radio station, so if you believe in our work, please click that Donate tab and become a member today. Thanks so much for listening, and stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.